The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, it's all over. Manchester City are champions. Sheffield United, West Brom and Fulham are down. And Manchester United, Leicester City and West Ham are in the Champions League. Roll on 2021-22. 9 for United against the 9 of Southampton. Who will they lose 9-0 to next season? Brighton are on a roll, beating Liverpool at whatever the opposite of a fortress is, Anfield. Jesse Lingard is reborn. City swap Burnley aside and there are good wins for Everton and Leicester. Plus, a great opportunity to talk about VAR for the first time. Contact, intent, deliberate attempts to play the ball. Just some of the fun in store at some point today. And how much behind-the-scenes information do you want from your broadcasters? And should it stop when they go to the toilet? All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max.
Jonathan Liu.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. John Bruin.
Hello, Max.
Dave writes, I listened to Monday and Wednesday's pod on a run today. Have two pods in a row ever been more tonally diverse? Going from Jiz Hornkamp to the alleged systemic corruption within football's governing body. It's good to do a variety of things. And thanks for all your comments about all of them. James says, should we just give up predicting stuff and enjoy it? Man shrugging emoji. Well, let's start at Old Trafford. Manchester United 9, Southampton 0. Mohammed says, is there some curse that prevents any Premier League teams from scoring double figures? Why must the fun end at 9? Barry, why does it end at 9?
I don't know. I mean, United's 9th goal came in the knockings of added time, as I recall. It seems a very long time ago now. But, you know, 9 seems... I think 10 would be slightly cruel.
You think it's some kind of gentleman's agreement?
I don't think so. Maybe it's just the gods... Well, it would be ludicrous to suggest the gods were smiling on Southampton, but... yeah, I don't know. But 9 seems a nice figure. 10's a bit harsh. I was once on a football team that lost 13-1. It's quite dispiriting when it goes from 9 into double figures.
Were you the one going, come on, lads, it's still 0-0?
No, I very much wasn't. No, as I recall, I was my winger scored 6 of the 13, the guy I was supposed to be marking. He was just so fast.
When there are 9 goals, John Bruin, I find it hard to remember any of them. You know, it's sort of so many goals that they all... the only one that sticks in my mind is Cavani's header. And it's weird. I don't know if Manchester United are getting enough praise for winning 9-0. And I don't know if Southampton are getting enough stick for losing 9-0.
Yeah, I think that's true, actually. So Manchester United would seem to be third in the hierarchy of discussion in this game. Unfortunately, behind VAR and then Ralf Hasenhüttl's... we're going to have to call it a habit soon, aren't we, of losing games 9-0, where... I mean, Ralf Hasenhüttl is one of those managers that's talked about as, well, you know, could he manage one of the bigger clubs in football? And the problem does seem to be, if he gets a man sent off in the game, you're going to lose 9-0. Now, I don't know if Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Inter Milan or whatever are going to accept that, really. So, unlucky, Ralf. But yeah, Manchester United played, you'd have to say, very well. They were handed... an advantage in Alexandra Yankovic's mid-air assault on Scott McTominay. And then United put the hammer down. And this is a team that we've previously accused of not being ruthless enough. Like you said, you mentioned the Cavani goal. I can't remember that one. But Rashford's goal was good. And the Dan James one in the last minute, obviously. But there was... Let's mention VAR because... But I think that United could have had a penalty at the end of the first half. I think that would have made it 5-0 if Bruno Fernandes had scored from a pot spot. And it looked like Mike Dean had, at that point was delivering mercy to Southampton, or the VAR was. But that didn't happen either. And then mercy was turned off and Southampton were taken to the cleaners and there was a dodgy refereeing decision. What can we learn from a 9-0? Well, the last 9-0 that I remember attending was when Manchester United beat Ipswich 9-0 and United didn't win the league that season. So maybe that's a pointer to the way things are going to go.
Manchester United just beat a really, actually a quite good team, 9-0. And it's worth dwelling on. I think you're right. United aren't quite getting enough credit and Southampton aren't quite getting dunked on enough. It just... it's just, oh, well, oh yeah, obviously a team gets beaten 9-0 every season these days. That's just a thing that happens in the Premier League.
How sorry should we feel for Alexander Jankovic? Because it was his debut. He was clearly a little over-eager. I mean, I heard people saying, you know, he's not that kind of player. We don't know that. I mean, perhaps he does this every third game in the 23s and then just gets sent off. He had apparently put in a transfer request because he wasn't getting enough minutes. And you think, well, he could say the same after this game. Come on, Ralph. I only got 2 minutes today. But
well, he's got another 1 minute and 16 seconds on his CV. I felt a bit sorry for him. I mean, it was a vicious tackle and he could have done a lot of damage to Scott McTominay. Scott McTominay, I thought his goal was the pick of the bunch, I have to say, by the way. I have a certain amount of sympathy. He was clearly fired up for the game. He's only 19. It was his first Premier League start. It's at Old Trafford. But I'd be curious to know what the reaction of his teammates would be after the game. Because Southampton were hamstrung before he got sent off. They were missing 9 players through injury. I think 5 of whom at least would probably have been in the starting lineup. And then to leave his teammates high and dry, I'd be curious to know, would the senior players in the dressing room treat him with utter contempt after the game for leaving them in that position and them getting humiliated? Or would they sort of put an arm around the shoulder and have seen Ralph Hatton, who didn't seem to be feeling too magnanimous towards him when he was interviewed post-match, he looked pretty angry.
You've got to put
well, our own friend Marcus Bean, he got sent off in his debut as a senior player. He was playing for QPR against Wickham, who he would go on to represent with distinction. He got sent off after 77 minutes of his debut, but that was in a game where 3 other players got sent off as well, and his team were already behind when he went.
He was just trying to fit in.
But I remember him talking about that before, and I asked him, how did he feel? And he said, I thought my career was over. I thought that was it. I'd never play for them again. But he said, I think it was Ian Holloway was his manager at the time, and Ollie was, you know, don't worry about it. These things happen. I think Marcus's was different in that he got in a scrap with somebody and they both got sent off. So it wasn't like he left his team high and dry.
We should... If you want to do the VAR chat, we can do it now. Podreg says, should Southampton be given a replay after Benrecht's red card completely ruined their chances of a comeback at 6-0? Zinzan Donovan says, what is more tedious? VAR controversy, talking about VAR controversy, talking about VAR controversy, or talking about VAR controversy controversy? So let's try and do it economically then. The Che Adams offside in that game, no fan wants that to be offside, I don't think. What is the solution? Over to you.
He's offside. He's offside. Free kick. Free kick to the opposing team.
Really? Am I the only one that thinks I want a football where that isn't given as offside?
No. I'm with Johnny on this, actually. It used to be referee's decision is final. Now it's VAR's decision is final, but the referee sort of has another look at it, so it's his decision is final. So I'm going to stick with that final decision.
Okay. Barry?
My only solution to the VAR mess is managers get, like in cricket, 2 appeals per game and to use as they see fit. And if Ollie wanted to appeal that goal, then it's offside.
But the thing is about this appeal thing, Barry, I'm thinking about this. How does it work? Does Chris Wilder get on the line to Stockley Park and have a slanging match with, you know, Mike Dean in the booth or whatever over whether the decision is given?
Nothing is checked by VAR unless a manager says, I want to check it. And the trouble is...
And the manager has to say what he think happened, what his problem is with... the goal or the...
The trouble with that, Barry, sorry, is that in cricket, obviously, there are lots of wickets. You know, there aren't many games where... I know we're talking about a 9-0, but it doesn't happen very often. A goal is such a big moment that every manager would just appeal the first goal in the game.
No, but you only get 2, and if you waste it, then you've none left.
Well,
if you
possibly
waste your 2, you've none left.
Sorry, I'm still amazed that all of you, and I don't know what you think, Barry, think that, you know, are happy with Che Adams being offside there. I'm not happy about it.
I'm not happy with it. I think I thought the offside rule was fine as it was before VAR. If the flag goes up, you're offside. If it doesn't go up, you're not. But this is where we are now, and technically he is offside.
No, I agree that. So I think the law should change then, not VAR. I think the law, I don't know what it is.
But no matter how you change it, there's always going to be margin for nitpickery.
The Bednarak red, and I guess we can bring in the David Luiz challenge. We get to the Arsenal game later because they're similar incidents. I mean, I think Martial dives, and I think Mike Dean needs to see that at the monitor. But this idea that if you're not trying to play the ball means that, let's say, Luiz or Bednarak sort of grab the attacker around the neck, that is a red card. It seems to now be interpreted that if you are trying to get out of the way, that's a red. I'm not saying it's a VAR problem necessarily, but it seems that law is not a good idea. Agree or disagree?
Isn't it that you're making no attempt to play the ball? Isn't that that's the rule?
So had Luiz or Bednarak flung themselves and wiped out the player, but looked like they were trying to go for the ball, they'd have got a yellow card.
But the thing is, Max, in the papers yesterday, in one newspaper, Mark Halsey said that the decision to send off David Luiz was correct. And in another, Mark Clattenburg, for another former referee, or current referee, said that it was incorrect. So if the referees don't know, I certainly don't.
Johnny?
The reason for abolishing the triple jeopardy rule was because, you know, it does kind of hopelessly tilt games on what are often quite minor infringements.
Anyway, Southampton have requested referee Mike Dean does not officiate their upcoming fixtures. They're appealing against the Bednarak red card. They also don't want Lee Mason, who was the fourth official at Old Trafford. He was the referee in their controversial defeat by Aston Villa. Eventually they'll run out, won't they? Sorry, we can't have any of these. We don't like you. We'll only have Craig Pawson. That's the only one we want. Ludicrous. All five games on Wednesday were away wins. First time in English Football League history, five or more games have been won by the away team. The sort of most sensational win was Brighton's win at Liverpool. Successive home defeats for the first time since 2012. Liverpool haven't scored at home in the league since the 27th in that one-all draw with West Brom. They haven't won at home in the league since beating Spurs in mid-December. John C says, since the panel said Brighton needed to worry about relegation, they've taken 9 points, added 3 clean sheets, moved up to 15th. Not really a question, just a thank you. They won at Leeds and Liverpool. They've beaten Spurs, drawn with Fulham at home. And Graham Potter said, look, we deserved this. It wasn't like we parked the bus and nicked a 1-0. This was different, Barry, to the Burnley win at Anfield, wasn't it? They were the better team for the whole game as well.
Yeah, I thought this was a much better performance from Brighton than their win against Tottenham at the weekend, to be honest. Liverpool were strangely flat and lethargic and devoid of inspiration. But Brighton took the game to them, got lots of players forward, certainly didn't sit back and hope for the best, and it was a thoroughly deserved win. Their first at Anfield since 1982, when I was just 9 years old with my whole life ahead of me.
Sweet little Barry.
Yeah, sweet little Barry. Wanted to be a bin man.
Did you?
Or an airline pilot.
Oh, okay.
Now look at the state of me. But it was a hugely impressive performance, and like I say, I thought it was much better than their performance against Spurs, which wasn't bad, but I thought they were slightly overpraised for that performance.
Johnny, I mean, so many great performances in that Brighton team. You know, the back three were great. Bissouma was great. Dan Byrne was, you know, sort of really fun footballer to watch. Solly March was great. I don't know if there's someone you wanted to pick out specifically.
Oh, yeah, I mean, Byrne, the world's biggest wing-back. He's just a great big lovable shaggy dog of a player. The thing about Brighton is that for all the trouble they seem to be in earlier in the season, their underlying numbers were incredibly strong. If you look at the chances they were creating and the quality of the chances they were creating, they were I think a sort of a top six, top eight side with really poor finishing. You know, if Mope wasn't scoring for them there, you know, then there wasn't really a huge amount to fall back on. And their problem earlier in the season was essentially putting chances away. Their build-up play and their organisation was very good. So I think what we're seeing now is kind of a regression to the mean slightly. I don't think Brighton ever really were in that much trouble. It was just they were getting unlucky in a few games. They were losing games by quite tight margins. And I still haven't quite worked out who scored their goal. I don't know what the official line on it was, but you know, maybe they deserved that little bit of luck.
Back to Brighton, John. Stunning performance, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, we can say Liverpool played badly, definitely, but I think they were nullified by Brighton. I watched the Spurs game, and I agree with Barry that Brighton in that game against a worse team, it has to be said, were a little more nervy, whereas they looked so assured at Anfield. A player to pick out, I mean, I think he got player of the match on the TV was Adam Webster, who him, Lewis Dunk and Ben White is a pretty decent trio of defenders there. Graham Potter is a good manager. I've never really doubted that. I think Brighton have played well under him over the last two seasons, while, as Johnny says, you know, delivering decent numbers aside from scoring goals and winning matches. There's been patience with him. It's clear to me that he has a plan for every match. He's a very diligent manager. I'm a bit concerned about him, though, because he's doing so well that you start to move into the point where certain columnists start mentioning you in dispatches to be the next England manager. And that normally is the end.
See, I think Potter is doing well. He's perfect for Brighton fans because I think he's doing well, but not quite well enough to be linked with the bigger jobs. I think that's possibly why Southampton lost 9-0, because Ralph Hasenhüttl was starting to get maybe notions above his station.
Johnny says, Graham Potter looks more like a Guardian journalist than a football manager. Which Guardian journalist looks more like a football manager than a Guardian journalist?
That's, well, I think question. John, actually, I mean, currently in his sort of shaggy beard, it looks like a Russian Super League manager who's sort of... of one of the lower, you know, or maybe like one of those Bulgarian teams that you get in the first round of the Europa League, where the manager.
Don't you think climate change's George Monbiot looks like he could be the manager of Genoa or Torino
or Lille or someone like that?
Lille, really good. I think so.
Well, he'd have to go to Forest Green, surely.
Yeah, absolutely right. Liverpool. Klopp said they were mentally fatigued. You know, Brighton deserved to win. I have a question about Thiago, right? I mean, I think if you'd asked, I don't want to speak for you. You can all do that for yourselves on this platform. It's quite useful for that. But if any of you had like been given a list of players to select in centre midfield, and you had a choice of Thiago or Jordan Henderson, we all have picked Thiago because he's such a lovely footballer. But Jordan Henderson is just so important in midfield for Liverpool, and he's not there at the moment.
For a Klopp team, you'd pick Jordan Henderson, wouldn't you? A Jordan Henderson, perpetual motion, chasing the ball down. I feel sorry for Thiago because you were approaching Juan Sebastian Veron territory, aren't you? Veron was brought into a team which was starting to fall apart. The problem is that Liverpool have fallen apart very quickly. I think Thiago... he's possibly the wrong fit for Liverpool at this time, at a time when they need to be digging out performances with the athleticism with which they delivered their success.
I mean, I guess Thiago with Henderson is, you know, is better than Thiago and Shaqiri, right? Because they're sort of similarly lovely to watch, even though they're not doing a whole lot.
Yeah, I think Thiago is, people are saying, you know, he's not creating assists, or he's not making key passes, but he's never actually really been that sort of player. He's been more of the deep lying midfielder who plays the pass before the pass, or who feeds the fullback for the final ball. And one of the patterns of Liverpool's play recently is that Thiago kind of sits in that sort of central midfield, slightly to the right or left of the centre circle, and plays that ball into the channel for Salah or Mane, who's then cutting inside. And what happens then is, and you saw it time and again against Brighton, against a defence that is set and well organised, he's just running into traffic. And the way that Liverpool scored all those goals last season is they managed to get the ball into those positions, and they managed to get the fullbacks up before oppositions got set. They were so good in transition, they were so quick and sharp with their build-up play, that they just managed to get somebody under the byline. They managed to get get the ball to the fullback, or they managed to get Salah into a position before three or four defenders could surround him. And that's just not happening at the moment, because the whole idea of this Liverpool, it's built on transition play and getting into position quickly. And as anybody who's played five-a-side knows, the hardest time to get into, you know, to get a sprint on is when you've just weathered an attack, or whether, you know, or you've made a lung-busting run and they've, you know, they've won the ball and you have to go back. You know, those are the, and if you've got a tired team, mentally and physically fatigued, those are, that's what you miss most. You miss that sharpness in transition. And that's why Liverpool look like they're going nowhere these days, because they're getting the ball into those positions, but they're getting it into those positions too slowly. And so it looks like they're running into, well, they're running into mass defenders who kind of know what to do, and they're not turning and running.
Liverpool City is on Sunday, and City warmed up for that with a comfortable 2-0 win at Burnley. Sort of feel, Barry, slightly sorry for City fans in the fact that we don't discuss them at great length, because it's quite hard to come up with new interesting things to say about this team that are just in gear at the moment and looking so comfortable.
Is this you asking me to come up with something new to say about this team who look so comfortable?
Yes, please. I'll tell you what, Barry, I'll do you a deal. I won't ask you about Steve Bruce later. So there's the deal. If you answer this one, you don't have to do a new
question. Well, I could talk about Steve Bruce all day. I suppose I was impressed with Ilkay Gundogan. He seems to have never quite really settled into that City side and established himself as one of the big stars, whether it's through injury or the infrequency with which he starts. He may well start more often than I think, but this is just in my head. But he's been outstanding in recent games, and he was outstanding in this game. He'll pick out a brilliant pass, unbelievably creative. It took me quite some time to realise that Kevin De Bruyne wasn't actually playing in this game, because he was as good as Kevin De Bruyne often is against Burnley and made life very difficult for them.
Yeah, Dan does say, is everyone getting carried away with City? Toughest test to come this month. Pep says, we won six games in a row against teams in low positions. We know how tough it was to win these. Now we have Liverpool, Tottenham, West Ham, Manchester United and the Champions League restarting, a tough group of games. But we enjoy this win, have some good food and start to think about Liverpool. So look, we will see, won't we? John, you were more engaged by the press conference of Sean Dyche, weren't you? Which I thought was quite fun, because I think press conferences are essentially really boring. It's just sort of passing on information. Who's injured? Who isn't? Are you going to buy anyone? Do you respect the other manager? Yes. Then they say the other team are really good and it's going to be really tough, whatever, whoever they're playing. But Sean Dyche talked about playing looky-likies with his family and how much he enjoyed Bridgerton, which I've yet to watch.
I remember Richard Sadler, the Irish pundit, used to play for Millwall with Sean Dyche, saying that he's a great guy to have around. He's a real, he was the team captain of Millwall when Richie played there. And I spoke to David Edgar a few years ago, who played for Sean Dyche at Burnley, and said, you know, the guy is absolutely hilarious and, you know, really lifts the dressing room with his sense of humour. Now, I watched that and thought, I probably wouldn't fit in a football dressing room, because I found Sean Dyche's looky-likey game, like, that would be the worst afternoon in a pub ever. And I'm glad that I've never been to the pub with Sean Dyche. It sounded horrendous. Now, you know, I've been to many a Sean Dyche press conference, and he's good value. So you go to the pub for 4 hours at a time. I'd rather go to 4 hours of Sean Dyche's press conferences in which we discuss the fullback's form than go to the pub with him at all. I mean, Jesus Christ. It was just, you know, it's just not funny. And, you know, I'm not saying that I'm Peter Houston off or anything like that, but good God, no, please do not ever present me with that again.
Me and my wife will occasionally look around the restaurant and try and work out what sort of what date people are on, or what the, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't know if I've ever played looky likey. Although staring at Barry, he does look just like Penfold out of Danger Mouse, and you know,
that's a new one. I'm not sure whether or not I prefer that to Tom Watson, the former MP.
But you don't look like Tom anymore. He lost all that weight, didn't he? That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start at Villa Park. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Villa 1, West Ham 3. Tony says, will West Ham have the squad depth when they come up against the Bayerns, Barcelonas and Milans next season? And Colin says, as a West Ham fan, I'd like to know how we best go about slowly declining to finish one spot below the Europa League so we don't ruin the club for the following season. Jesse Lingard, Barry. I mean, that's so... I was just so pleased for him. You know, he hadn't started a league game for 399 days. He hasn't played for England since 2019. He said, I was smiling before the game and during. I just enjoyed playing football. It's been a long time. David Moyes says, if he keeps scoring two goals every game, he'll do very well for West Ham. I mean, that is, Peyton, that's quite an obvious statement.
Yeah, Jesse Lingard seems like a nice guy. I mean, I keep thinking he's a kid and he's 28 years old, I think. So he's been around a long, long time, and he kind of became, when Manchester United weren't doing well, he became a poster boy for fecklessness and being distracted with off-the-field activities. And he's had a rough time. I think his mum was ill and he looks after his younger siblings, both financially and just generally looking after them. Fair play to him. He's kept himself fit, obviously, despite only featuring in three matches, I think, for a total of 179 minutes so far this season. He was playing with a big smile on his face, and good luck to him. And another astute signing by David Moyes, who I have to say, I thought he was finished as a manager, but he's really doing well at West Ham. And if he hadn't done well, I think that would have been possibly his last ride on the merry-go-round. It would have been his turn to get off and let someone else on. So, yeah, good luck to them.
I think Emi Martinez, who's been brilliant for Villa, really wanted Jesse Lingard to get off to a good start as well and probably should have saved both those goals. But you're right about David Moyes, Barry. And Johnny, like, he brought in Ryan Fredericks to, like, give him some extra security ahead against Jack Grealish, which, I mean, doesn't sound like rocket science, but it's quite a smart thing to do. And they played really well. I thought Villa would win this game. They played really well. And when you look at their back four, which is what? Koufal, Dawson, Ogbonna and Cresswell. On paper, you think, that isn't great. But on the pitch, it's really good.
Yeah, I mean, and what Moyes has done, I think, is he's improved players. He's made players better through their combination with other players. So, you know, Koufal, who I think was a sort of 5 million from Slavia Prague, and Craig Dawson, who's like a loan from relegated Watford. These aren't household names. And, you know, if you remember at the start of the season, everybody was talking about the sale of Grady Diangana and it was kind of open revolt at West Ham. And you kind of wondered how Moyes was going to get a grip on the place. And yeah, he seems to have done it remarkably well. And his football brain has always been very sharp. The problem with Moyes has always been his demeanour, I guess, and the fact that he doesn't really inspire a fan base. But I mean, the results so far are speaking for themselves. I agree with a lot of people who say that they don't quite have the squad depth probably to see them through to the end of the season. I think they might well fall away, but he's done a fantastic job so far.
Dean Smith said, we got done on the counter-attack. Sunday league football, you wouldn't do that. Just to let you know, Dean, from experience, you absolutely would. Villa have sort of gone off the boil a little bit, haven't they, John?
Yeah. Just watching the match back last night, I saw there was footage of Dean Smith and Craig Shakespeare, Shaky, as John Terry calls him. They looked pretty flummoxed by what was going on. 2 or 3 weeks ago, yeah, we were praising them for how well they've done, and unfortunately they do look like they've perhaps been victims of the schedule, that a little bit like West Ham is a pretty thin squad, and it's just not their moment at the moment. I don't think you'll find a Villa fan that's going to complain too much at the moment. I think they've had a good season building on. I mean, they needed a draw against West Ham on the final day of the season to escape relegation last season, and they've got away from that. But West Ham, highest tally after 22 matches in the top flight for them of all time, and actually came third one season in 85-86. So you're facing a team essentially riding the crest of a wave for Aston Villa. So I don't think we can criticise them too much. We just wonder if this slide continues.
Rob writes, having listened to you droning on about how exciting Leeds are all season, I finally get to watch them. And OMG, why can't football always be like this? It was Everton's fourth away win on the trot. Barry, it was a breathless game of football, this. I mean, something about Leeds that they make other teams really fun. You know, Everton aren't intrinsically fun. You know, when they win, it's kind of okay. And when they lose, it's kind of okay. But in this game, like, Everton were brilliant for 45 minutes. Then Leeds sort of battered them for the second half. I just loved this game of football. And bearing in mind, I think it was the 20th game I watched yesterday. I wasn't necessarily expecting to enjoy it so much.
Yeah, another roller coaster ride from Leeds, who, you know, we've eulogised about them at great length. I think people who aren't convinced by them yet are not going to be at this stage. But I love watching them play. I thought they could have won this game. It was a good performance by them, and it took some heroics from Olsen in goal for Everton to keep them at bay. A good win for Everton.
I mean, there were two moments in yesterday's football I was upset that didn't result in goals. One was when Gundogan chested the ball off for Gabriel Jesus, and I really wanted that to be a goal because it was beautiful. And the other was Alioski's volley from the corner, which hit the post.
Oh, that was amazing.
Such a great shame that didn't go in.
We've been talking about rule changes, VAR, triple jeopardy. The one rule change I think I would make to the game, if I could only make one, is that a goal scored on the volley directly from a corner from outside the area, two goals. you get two goals for that.
Interestingly, the Marseille owner like genuinely wants to change the rule where like great goals are worth more. So, you know, that would have been a two, and maybe you have like a judging panel, you know, on the side. Like, oh, that's a like three,
strictly,
yeah,
come down.
That's a three, yeah. From the Croatian judge. But Everton, John, they're solid, aren't they? And like after that game against Newcastle, where we were all a bit like, we were just about to start taking them seriously. They have a good manager. They have some good players, I guess.
Yeah, and Dominic Calvert-Lewin scored. It had been a long time for him. He's one of those players, though, isn't he, who offers far more than goals. It really leads the line very well.
Fulham 0, Leicester 2. And part of my annoyance with this, Barry, was this was on at the same time as Everton Leeds. And so it was white v blue with both kits. And so when I was trying to sort of focus, I just needed to concentrate that extra 1% when both these Everton Leeds was in like the palate cleanser game. You know, the one that isn't a 6 or an 8. It's in the middle, just to make you think, I don't even get half an hour just to myself, just to detox before they all start again. Anyway, Leicester a third. They did it without Vardy and Didi Castagna-Fofana. That second goal was beautiful from James Justin. Is James Justin, Barry, knocking on the very heavy right back door and the not quite as heavy left back door for England?
Yeah, probably. There haven't been too many fullbacks who've been more impressive than him this season. That was a brilliant goal, a long busting run up the pitch. He started and finished that move, and why not?
Okay, and what about James Maddison? While you're being so generous, doling out the caps.
I'd happily give James Maddison a cap. I think he's a great player. I mean, if I was in charge of dishing out the caps to England players, you'd probably get one, Max, because I'd be giving them to players I'd be very confident would not serve their country well or with anything resembling distinction. The England squad at the Euros would be piss poor.
I don't know. I don't want a pity England cap, Barry. I mean, I'd take it for the anecdote. Let's face it, I could do with some new ones. Iheanacho had a good game in for Vardy, Johnny, didn't he? And I just was thinking, it was a weird life, the life of a reserve striker. I mean, not as weird as the life of a reserve goalkeeper. But, you know, if you're Iheanacho, you're getting paid a lot of money. You're not going to play very often. I don't know. It's just an odd existence. Maybe Jamie Vardy is like Jimmy Anderson. And he'll just get better and quicker. And you know, score more as he gets older, and he'll be 40, and constantly being asked if this is his last season, and he'll say no, I'm happy to carry on. Jacob wrote something about Fulham. He said there's something sad about watching Fulham, an engaging team with a smart manager, lots of likeable players. There were times when they looked to be Leicester's equals, but their problems stem from a lack of decisiveness in both boxes. It was hard not to wonder if they'd be more effective with a more mobile striker than Alexander Mitrovic. I think he's pretty much got it spot on there, John, hasn't he?
Yeah. Mitrovic is in that class of Robert Earnshaw, Darren Huckabee, who is too good for the Championship, not quite there at the Premier League. That's not to
the Cameron Jerome zone.
Yeah, and that's not to demean any of those players who are excellent footballers.
Lewis Graben.
Scott Parker is almost in sort of Graham Potter territory of a few weeks ago in saying, you know, in a slightly more upbeat way, such as Scott Parker's way of saying, we'll be fine, we'll be fine. We've got 17 games to change things for ourselves. Fulham haven't actually been that bad, but they just don't possess the quality to get the job done, I'm afraid. If Scott Parker had better players, particularly up front, then maybe he might be joining Graham Potter in being mentioned for the doomed England spot.
Do we prefer the Cameron Jerome zone or the Lewis Graben Gulf for that? Or the Darren Huckabee hiatus?
I think you've been harsh on Huckabee there.
Huckabee did all right.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Well, no, but Huckabee at the start of his career was good for in the Premier League, but later on he was sort of not quite there, I think. And then he was a big star in America, of course.
With the greatest football interview of all time. Do you have it? If you go into YouTube as soon as this podcast finishes and types Darren Huckabee legend, it's an absolutely wonderful piece of video. Let's go to Molineux. Wolves 2, Arsenal 1. That João Moutinho goal. I mean, the ball stayed ball. His first ever goal at Molineux. It was a wonderful goal.
It was a wonderful goal. This was an entertaining game in which Arsenal, I think, almost reached peak Arsenal, because they should have been out of sight before David Luiz got sent off. Then David Luiz got sent off, harshly in my opinion, and it all fell apart for them. Wolves really needed that win, and to win it with such a fine strike. I think they were slightly lucky, but they'll take it.
Oh yeah, Arsenal were brilliant, Johnny, for about half an hour, weren't they?
I mean, it's interesting that people saying peak Arsenal. I got a lot of messages from Arsenal fans going, well, that's the season gone again. I'm feel really angry that this one decision and now we're going to go off on a spiral again. And which I think speaks a lot to the mindset of Arsenal fans. They do feel like they are God's cursed children. And if you look at they were in a. If a run of form is so brittle that a single decision against Wolves can throw you totally off kilter, then I think maybe your run of form isn't quite as strong as you thought it was. They seem to be playing fine, and it's a total mental thing, that there's always been for the last few years this sort of fatalism around Arsenal that when one thing goes wrong, it's like, well, here we go again. And then, 10 games later, 10 games down the road and, two managerial crises, they remember, oh, no, actually, hang on, we're quite good. We've got some decent players. And they sort of kick back into gear. And, you wonder whether it's going to be one of those again where they'll spend another few weeks just arguing amongst themselves in a total funk. And then, oh, hang on, no, we're all right.
In good news for Arsenal fans, Nicola Pepe is finally starting to look like a proper player. And it's been a long time coming, but I would take heart from that.
Yeah, there you are. It's all okay. I mean, they've had more sendings off than all the other football teams in the world put together in the last few. David Luiz has more red cards and conceded more penalties than any other player in the Premier League since his Arsenal debut. Arsenal are top of the league in terms of red cards, and eighth in terms of yellows, but 20th in terms of fouls per game. So they really do pick out the big ones. Bernd Leno's red card. On the Paul Doyle law, this would be a penalty and not a red. Paul Doyle's got me under his wing. I really feel I'm sort of really pushing. I push it more than Paul Doyle does now, and credit him on social media. He probably has no interest or has never seen this. But
what is the Doyle law again? Sorry.
The Doyle law is, okay, sorry, just for anyone who doesn't know, is if you deny a goal scoring opportunity anywhere on the pitch, it's a penalty, but not a red card. So Bernd Leno denies a goal-scoring opportunity. It's not in the box, but the ref gives a penalty. If there's a foul in the box...
I don't think he did deny a goal-scoring opportunity, though.
Well, if the ball had dropped, then you would suggest they'd have a chance of scoring. So it's an opportunity of scoring.
Yes, I'm with you, John. And for example, a foul in the box that isn't denying a goal-scoring opportunity is not a penalty. It's a free kick inside the box. And we all love free kicks inside the box.
Okay.
Are you with us, Johnny?
Yeah, I quite like that. Just
for the record, when Max suggested this on the radio one morning, Ali McCoist literally burst out laughing.
He's a very generous broadcaster, Ali, and he laughs when I say a lot of things.
But he wasn't laughing with you, he was laughing at you, and by extension, Paul Doyle.
Because it was so well, so bloody ridiculous, in fact, from Leno. What on earth had gone through, well, his mind at the point where, okay, it's bounced up, I know what I'll do, and just, you know, waft the ball, waft his hand at the ball. I just, it was so ridiculous that you almost have to put a player in the stocks and get him sent off for that, because it was so stupid. I don't actually disagree. I think Paul Doyle's idea, or Doyle's idea, is not a bad one, but there's got to be some sort of humiliation clause at that point, and the walk's got to be made.
Yeah, you feel the feeling that Bernd Leno, if he hadn't put his hand there, would have just chested it out of play anyway. I mean, it's yeah, a really weird thing to do. And also, he was so calm about getting the red. He was like, yeah, there we are. It happens. There was a brilliant clip recently of Neville Southall coming out of the box and handling it with the commentator, with the best use of the word allegedly, where Neville Southall literally catches the ball, I think he's at Loftus Road, about 10 yards out of the box, and the commentator says, Neville Southall there allegedly taking the ball, handling the ball outside the area. He's actually holding the ball, and he's sort of on the centre circle. Sheffield United 2, West Brom 1. Sheffield United's third win in 5. They're flying. Barry, can they do it?
I don't think so. I think Brighton's resurgence in form may put pay to any chance they have of staying up. Interesting in this game, because our friend Jay from Blades Analytic on Twitter, he's normally very sympathetic towards Sheffield United and their players, but he was furious with Oliver Norwood in this game, with good reason, because he bottled a 50-50 challenge with Robert Snodgrass in midfield, which allowed West Brom to break up the pitch and score and go a goal up. Norwood then didn't come out for the second half. I don't know if that was punishment for I'm loath to use the word cowardice, but hesitation, we'll say, be kind. But Sheffield United turned it around. Jaden Bogle scored a good goal. Aaron Ramsdale, who's had a tough season, saved brilliantly from Callum Robinson. And then Billy Sharp, who was about to be on the verge of being replaced by Rian Brewster, he scored a good winner. So another good win for Sheffield United. And as Chris Wilder said, look, we have nothing to lose. We had nothing to lose in this game, and we've nothing to lose in general. So all they can do is try and win as many games as possible, but I don't think it'll be enough.
I think hesitation, just a minute, would be different if you could penalise someone for cowardice during it. Mojo Duffelcoat says, seeing as West Brom looks certs to be relegated, could and should Big Sam go full shithouser and resign before the end of the season to maintain his never-been-relegated record? And if so, would it be funny? Johnny?
I think that's exactly what he's going to do. You can tell from his early, you know, his early weeks at the club that he now realises that he's inherited a much bigger and deeper and more intractable mess than he probably thought he was going to, and you know he's already been making little rumblings about transfer business. He's been talking about getting this, cancelling the season because of COVID, and the best greatest Big Sam Great Escapes. He gets stuck in, and you can see him you can see him ticking. You can see he's already starting the work of melding everybody and getting everybody together on the same page. And you don't get too much of that. You know, he just seems like a very annoyed old man who has been missold some PPI and is now trying to work out how to take it back.
I think that in the same way, if you play a certain number of games, you qualify for a Premier League winner's medal. If you manage a certain number of games and the team goes down, then that should go on your CV as well.
Newcastle 1, Palace 2. In his programme, Steve Bruce, I don't know who the programme's for at the moment. He'd written about the team's green shoots of recovery since their win at Everton. We certainly didn't deserve to get beat, but we've got to be more clinical, take our chances. I still feel this is a slightly different Newcastle. I'm on a WhatsApp group with two Newcastle fans, two friends of mine who seemed not as upset currently after this performance. You know, two mid-ranging Premier League sides, both could have won it. One did.
Well, I did notice on one Newcastle fan website that they were complaining about his kamikaze approach and Newcastle being too attacking, which is certainly a change in tone, but complaining nonetheless.
Gary Cahill became Palace's oldest ever goalscorer in the Premier League at 35 years and 45 days. It was very wet. You could see when they were panning across the team, you could see the referee's assistant just sort of shivering like that, thinking, I didn't want to be there. And they could at least let Steve Bruce should borrow one of Big Sam's. He's got a really good coat with a big hood. Steve Bruce just was like, his head was sopping wet. You know, it's ridiculous that you can't put a hood on because it's too manly or something. Anyway, well done to Crystal Palace. Andros Townsend missed an absolute sitter, which was quite funny, by the way. Spurs-Chelsea tonight. Jose's apparently made up with Dele Alli, so that's nice, isn't it? And more importantly, the Chelsea winger Paul Cannaville, former Chelsea winger Paul Cannaville, is critically ill after complications from emergency surgery. He became the first ever black footballer to play for Chelsea in 1982. He's in hospital, according to a statement released by the Paul Cannaville Foundation. So we obviously wish him a speedy recovery, send our best wishes to his friends and family. That'll do for part two. We'll be back with any other business in just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Ian Wright has expressed his disappointment after an Irish teenager who admitted racially abusing him in private messages on Instagram escaped a criminal conviction. At a sentencing hearing on Wednesday, Judge David Waters said he didn't see anything to be gained by imposing a criminal conviction and handed Patrick O'Brien probation. Ian Wright said, seeing this judgment, I can only wonder what deterrent there is for anyone else who spouts this kind of vile racist abuse. No judge's claim of naivety or immaturity will ever be acceptable to us. The supposed immaturity and naivety of our attackers is never any comfort.
The interesting thing about that is the judge cited the fact that Ian Wright had forgiven the boy as one of the mitigating circumstances for not giving him a criminal record, but he got no punishment of any kind. I think he should have got a criminal conviction and a good dose of community service. I don't think anything would be served by sending him to prison. But I mean, it was weird because he sent the abuse to Ian Wright after losing a game of FIFA in which Ian Wright was his legend. Just bizarre, but I suppose the kid has been publicly humiliated, so that's...
My gut instinct is, yes, I agree with you completely on that, Barry. And like we said on Monday, until social media companies start caring about it... There's an article in the paper today about a company that is offering footballers the sort of detective skills to find these anonymous people, you know, because the social media companies aren't doing enough, which sort of goes down a road of vigilantism.
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit on Dan Rowan's report on the BBC News last night about how one police force had written to Twitter or got in touch with Twitter to ask for the details about some, you know, particular racist tweet, and got a response from Twitter 6 months later, which I think shows how, you know, where policing this kind of thing stands in the priorities of the big tech companies. But from the other side of it, I mean, sentencing and, you know, criminal convictions for racist abuse seem to be, you know, whatever the opposite of an aggravating factor is. If it's in a football context, it seems to have precisely the opposite effect. You know, this football racism is convicted and sentenced so unbelievably lightly in this country. Still, you know, you hear about the fans who throw banana skins or whatever and getting something like, you know, probation or getting a fine or getting, you know, 2 weeks in prison. And I think until people see offenders getting, you know, getting proper sort of life-changing sentences for what can often be life-changing abuse or life-changing crimes, they're going to continue to act with impunity without any real fear of consequence.
You know, Alex Yankovic, the Southampton player we talked about at the top, you know, he got racist abuse. It does seem to be now any black player who doesn't win a football match will get some sort of direct message of racist abuse. And like Troy said, it goes down to, you know, it's up to the individual whether they want to like post out that it's happened or not. And it goes against all my instincts to not say that it's happening, because you need to keep talking about it to make people realize it stops. But it feeds the machine, right? More people see that you can do it and get to people, more people do it. I don't know.
Well, if the only consequence is outrage, if the only consequence is, you know, people put out really kind of earnest statements, then that is not a deterrent. If the consequence is outrage, people putting out earnest statements, and, you know, you get cops knocking on your door at 6 a.m. the next morning, and you get hauled in front of court, and you lose your job, and you'll go to jail for a considerable length of time, people are going to think twice about that. But it needs the tech companies, and it needs the, you know, police, and it needs the courts as well to play ball, and they're not doing that.
But looking at the screen grabs some footballers post when they are racially abused, I'm guessing here, but a lot of it seems to be posted by people who are not necessarily in the UK. So presumably they're outside of the jurisdiction of the UK justice system.
I was talking to Sanjay from Kick It Out about this yesterday, actually, and he was saying that one of the things they're working on is, or you know, one of the things they're pushing the social media platform to do is for things like computer hacking or money laundering or kind of insider trading, there is a central database of IP addresses, and if a transaction is coming from a certain IP address, you know, they know it gets flagged up, it gets blocked. You could do that with dodgy, you know, racist, homophobic, sexist content on the internet. You could find out who the offending accounts are and the offending IP addresses are, and you couldn't, because at the moment you're playing whack-a-mole with addresses. You know, you set up a new account, you set up a new email address. If you have to, every time you want to racially abuse someone, you have to buy a new computer. That's going to be, you know, a slightly bigger deterrent.
The football keeps on coming, doesn't it? Full round of Premier League fixtures at the weekend before the FA Cup fifth round next midweek. The big one is Liverpool City, John. And if we want, you know, a title race, or as Sid would say, hey, Liga, we need Liverpool to beat City, don't we?
Yes, we do. Though, can we really hold out much hope for that? I'm recalled that there'll be certain times when, say, an Alex Ferguson team or would be in this type of position and pull themselves out of the mire with missing players by downing the opponent. So that would be, say, the famous 49 game, unbeaten game, where Arsenal were, let's say, nudged out of that game by Manchester United's tactics, or one where Chelsea were unbeaten and they were beaten by a Darren Fletcher goal. You need that type of performance from Liverpool against a team like City, who do seem to be flowing. I think their best hope, actually, is that City do a City, which they are occasionally prone to missing the gears and just falling apart. But let's see if Pep Guardiola's teams smell blood. I suspect they probably do.
Sandy says, can you resurrect Fitbar Corner for an honourable mention? Hamilton Academicals have apologised for a live stream when... That's the wrong choice of words, isn't it? I guess this doesn't quite fit. Co-commentator Bobby Bullock said on air that he'd been away for a jobby at half-time. The moment was beamed out across the internet coverage during the Accies match with Ross County at the Fountain of Youth Stadium. So he was the summariser, and he'd been to the toilet, and then when he came back, he hadn't turned his microphone back on. And then he was apologising that no one had been able to hear him for a while, and he'd explained, sort of, he went into quite a lot of detail. The club didn't find this funny, and the person will not be used again. They called him a contractor, which I... That's a noun and a verb, isn't it? You know, and it's like, maybe that's his superhero name.
I thought the funniest thing was the incredibly po-faced statement from the club. You know, it just draws attention to it.
Yes, a contractor used by the club on summarising co-commentary duties overstepped the mark this evening with a very poor attempt at humour. The club didn't find this funny, and the person will not be used again. Our apologies for this. So there we are.
They could get Sean Dyche in as on co-coms, and he could pick out looky likeys from the various players on the field, I suppose.
I was going to say, not pick out looky likeys from his stool sample. But, you know, now, I believe at some point there's going to be a po-faced statement from the Guardian saying these four contractors will not be used again, even when they're not contracting. Anyway, thanks for your time, Johnny. Appreciate it.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, John.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome, Max.
We will return on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.